How can we get our global system to move in a more sustainable direction? Some would say the task is just too vast and complicated to tackle, but there are those who believe starting with local sustainability could be the beginnings of a solution to the frustration and desperation that appear to be so prevalent in the world today. Patrick Mazza is the editor of the Raven Journal and a longtime analyst and organizer with an emphasis on ecological sustainability. He's currently working on a paradigm he calls Building the Future in Place. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
So it sounds like what you're trying to do, or one of the things you're trying to do, is sort of uproot the entire global system we're living under and come up with an entirely new system. Kind of reminds me of what some of the ecological thinkers and the post-socialist thinkers are thinking. You know, we have to really do something that's never been done before to integrate all systems to develop a more just, humane, democratic world. Is that what your aim is?
Yeah, absolutely. I would revise that a little bit, you know, from uproot to, you know,
transform?
plant new roots. I mean, it is, you know, it is a boggling task to think about this world system and how interlinked it is and how difficult it is to find leverage points on the system to change it. So there are a really stunning number of new visions and new thinkers out there that are looking at how to transform this world system. My approach has long been in the local and regional. So I have roots in the bioregional movement. You know, I live in the Pacific Northwest, a.k.a. Cascadia, where...
Ecotopia, as Hollenbach.
I actually knew Ernest back in the day. Ecotopia was definitely an inspiration for me. The idea that you could create an ecological society in place. And that's really informed what I've done, you know, for decades. So, you know, so thinking about where do we find leverage points to begin a transformation, especially considering how deep we are in the hole here, you know, that's to me the most intimidating factor. I try to veer away from utopianism because, you know, it seems like we're past the point of being able to create utopias. I think what we really need to do is take a realistic assessment of where we are at overall in the world and begin to think about how we prepare for what's coming, to build the strength in our communities for what's coming, and to use all those means as well to mitigate what's coming. And that's, you know, that's what I'm thinking about in terms of where I'm taking my Substack, which is a phrase I came up with, building the future in place. Last summer, you know, wandering around, flailing my hands, saying, looking at everything that's going on, climate, global war, political breakdown in the United States, and ask, what can you do with a world like this? And, you know, kind of rooted in all my experience and thinking, I came up with the phrase building the future in place. And I happened to Google it and I found like, you know, what, billion results. And that phrase had not appeared anywhere. And I thought, boy, is that strange, you know, because there's so much thinking along those lines. So I've been trying to conceive a paradigm based on my experience, based on what a lot of other people are thinking about how you really begin to mobilize places to begin to build a future of strong communities, strong places, strong regions that can really handle what's coming down the line. I mean, the kind of things...
Have you paid much attention to what's going on in Rojava in northern Syria, where they're trying to develop an autonomous, some would say utopian area? Although they wouldn't say that.
I have paid attention to it, and I have to say I'm a little skeptical. I'm not skeptical about the experiment itself, but the alignment of the Kurdish forces with the U.S. occupation forces in that region and how I think they're being used.
Although it's very specifically against ISIS and Al-Qaeda, isn't it? The U.S. didn't help them when the Turks attacked them.
Yeah, but, you know, leaving that aside, yeah, I think Rojava is very interesting. I think other you know, places where what's being called the new municipalism is very interesting. Barcelona comes up as one of those places. Certainly, you know, the, you know, cooperation Jackson in Mississippi trying to build a solidarity economy. These are solid examples of places which are trying to coalesce around a different vision for how to do things. And that I think is hugely important. I don't see this as abandonment of all the other stuff we're doing. I mean, we need to keep some focus on our national politics. We need to keep a focus on climate politics at all levels. And so this is an additional strategy that is kind of a no regrets. If we don't have a catastrophic election in 2024 and see Trump come back and, you know, kind of stuck with the same old Democratic Party paradigm, well, it still makes sense to build the future in place, because we're not going to get, you know, despite the fact there has been some action on climate at the national level, it's certainly not enough. And again, you know, the climate issue, you know, we certainly see how it's escalated. You know, as somebody who's worked on it for a long time, I mean, it's been emotionally difficult. I'll confess that, to see that last year we did exceed 1.5 degrees C. And we see record temperatures in ocean, atmosphere, storms and fires, you know, and well, the world, you know, continues to plow ahead with new drilling, new pipelines, and the wars really distracting from the climate issue. We need to look at everything we face, especially from the standpoint, as, you know, started this conversation, where do we have leverage points? It is so easy for people to throw up their hands confronting a very integrated, interlocked global system with massive corporate and political powers and say, what can I do about all of this?
But there is all this activism on any number of issues if you look around, and there are these local resilience movements, for example, that I know you want to go far beyond, but they do exist.
Oh, yes. And that, you know, and that's what's heartening about this. What I think we need to do is coalesce a lot of movements that are happening right now into what's been called movement of movements. You know, we've heard that phrase.
Paradigm movement.
Yeah. You know, whatever you want to, you know, I mean, right now there's a tremendous amount of activity going on in public banking, for example. And I see that as the keystone, gaining control of capital, gaining control of the money. You know, as having studied sustainability for decades, it's so often where it's really the gap between what we know we can do and what we don't do is about money. So, you know, California has a lot of stuff going on in this area, different states. And then there's social housing. We now, with the housing crisis going on in the world, we see a movement to emulate great social housing models like Vienna. And again, you know, take housing, at least a segment out of it, out of the market. We see movements for local food, local economy. These are all, you know, local broadband. These are all important building blocks. And often these movements happen in different silos. And I think the, you know, one of the models that has come up, which Barcelona has brought up, is the public assembly model. You know, we've got a lot of thinking going back to Murray Bookchin in the 70s and 80s about the possibility for creating community assemblies that create a dual power, a new sense of legitimation.
Anything really, like the town hall meetings in New England?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it is. New England is an example, is a classic example of that. But Barcelona did institute community assemblies based in neighborhoods. So I think we need to find places to come together and really coalesce and see how our different movements can integrate with each other and support each other. I also think it's really important to, you know, a lot of the stuff going on in local resilience, it tends to be civil society that doesn't have much reference to local institutions of government. I think we need to use the power of the state, of local governments and state governments where we can.
The conservatives certainly recognize that.
Yes, yes. I mean, that is true. You know, they've definitely, in some ways, out-organized us at the local and state level because, you know, they have that kind of more traditional orientation. I mean, we need to take power in local governments and state governments where we can and use those institutions to create a network of new community institutions that can meet basic human needs. And in that, build a new political consensus. I don't see it stopping at the local area. I mean, a lot of important initiatives begin, you know, important initiatives generally don't begin at the center. They begin at the periphery. So you have the example out of my own city, Seattle, where the idea of the $15 an hour minimum wage took root and enacted the first $15 an hour in the country. And over recent years, it passed as a ballot initiative in Florida, which is by no means a liberal state. You have the classic example of feed laws in Germany to pay people a guaranteed rate for feeding solar and wind energy into the grid, which began in the city of Aachen. So if you can create initiatives at a local and state and regional scale that actually show they're working, they can spread laterally across the landscape and, you know, eventually make it into national legislation.
Yeah, even in conventional political discourse, they talk about the states as being models for the national level. Yeah.
Laboratories of democracy.
That's right. Yeah.
No, of course, we've seen some of the opposite in what's been called laboratories of autocracy, the very gerrymandered states such as, you know, Texas and Tennessee, which are enacting some horrendous laws. We have problems in democracy in the United States. Nobody can doubt that. So where do you begin to create leverage points where we can revive democracy, where we can revive democratic participation and democratic power? And obviously, it's the closer you are to home, the easier it is.
Do you get the impression that forming a political party is the way to go? I'm sure that a lot of people in the Green Party think that, but you're thinking in broader terms, I'm assuming.
I'm thinking in broader terms. You know, I actually have some Green Party experience in the 80s and 90s. And we ran into some walls. I don't need to go into them too deeply here, but you know, the barriers against third parties are astoundingly great and they've only grown greater. For example, in Washington State, you know, we've instituted what's called the Louisiana primary, where the top two vote getters in a primary are the people who get on the ballot.
Same in California, yeah.
You know, sometimes they're two Democrats, sometimes they're two Republicans.
Yeah.
But the barriers to ballot access are astounding. And, you know, the last successful third party creation was the Republicans. I think, you know, the example of the 1890s Populist Party, I think, is important. You know, they gained a lot of traction and a lot of their ideas were indeed adopted in the progressive movement of the early 20th century. And that, you know, that is, you know, the rationale for third parties is to float ideas that are later adopted by the major parties. I mean, a lot of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was unemployment insurance, old age pensions were were ideas that were floated by the Socialist Party. And so I don't oppose the idea of third parties, but I think, you know, I think you can work around them. I think very many areas of the country, very many cities are kind of uniformly Democratic, and you know, very many of the areas where we could organize these kind of local coalitions that provide consensus around a real transformatory agenda are, you know, kind of one-party areas as well. And as well, they're a lot nonpartisan in their elections. So there's limited utility to third parties. I think the Green Party would be, and other parties would be advised to focus on winning state legislative elections. There's any number of local Green elected officials.
Oh yeah.
You know, then that, you know, and that's important, but could Greens target and other third parties target winning in legislative districts and begin to assemble some power in state legislatures? I think that's something to think about.
And one of the problems they face is if a candidate gets in, they don't get appointed to committees and their influence is deliberately limited. So,
oh, yeah.
So they might then convert to Democrat just to have some influence.
Yeah. You know, I think the more productive route right now is to infiltrate the major parties. And obviously the party which is most amenable to these kind of ideas is the Democratic Party.
I mean, as Bernie Sanders understood, evidently.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And yeah, they'll try and fight you at every level. I mean, the party machinery is powerful. You know, having participated in the nonprofit world, I've seen the network in action, you know, the networks of law firms and political consultancies and big time funders and, you know, all of that is a tough nut to crack. I think organizing around that, building consensus outside of the political parties and kind of importing that into the parties, making it such a strong consensus that, yeah, they'll have to go for it. So, yeah, you have, you know, powerful advocacy for public banking now in Democratic legislatures in California, Washington.
Look to North Dakota as the example.
Yes, the public bank, North Dakota Public Bank, which is the state bank, which makes a profit, returns it to the state coffers, a product of the populist era, and did not have to be bailed out in 2008. They didn't make those bad investment decisions, you know, that the big banks did. So we really need to get ourselves free of the big banks. There's no reason why, you know, public agencies should be depositing their money with Wells Fargo and Bank of America and Chase. I mean, they'll just use that money. They'll use that money around the world, often to undermine local economies. So we really need to get control. I mean, Public Banking Institute is doing phenomenal work in this area. Ellen Brown and Public Banking Institute are doing great work in this area. I mean, they're a great organization.
Anything else you'd like to say about creating this new world, this more decent world?
I think we face some really tough times ahead. I think our economic situation is unstable.
Even if they report growth rates and low unemployment.
Yeah, well, those statistics should be questioned. There is actually a website called Shadow Stats, which looks at what would unemployment be measured at if it was 1980s or 1990s criteria. What would economic growth be measured? What would inflation be measured? And it's uniform that economic growth would be lower, inflation would be far higher, and unemployment would be far higher. There's different statistics now which show, you know, the unemployment more like 8%, and it could be higher. But in any case, whatever the validity of the statistics, this economy is leveraged to the hilt with bubbles. And the prospect of another large depression is quite real.
Even with the regulations in place, they're just not enough.
Yeah, what regulations? Obviously. So I think the important thought to leave you with is that right now we need to be planting ideas for when the crisis comes. You know, there's that, you know, a famous quote from somebody who I totally disagree with in any other way, Milton Friedman, who, you know, who was advertising or was promoting free market economics in the post-World War II era when it seemed like, you know, Keynesianism, you know, had prevailed. And in the economic crisis of the 70s, that was turned back and his form of, you know, neoliberal free market economics prevailed in the 80s. And what he was saying is, you know, it's our job to, you know, while we're, you know, to keep ideas on the table, I'm paraphrasing, to keep ideas on the table that seem impossible for when the crisis comes seem necessary. There's a lot of people putting out a lot of great ideas right now. I think we need to coalesce them in a coherent form and have them on the table with some level of political organization behind them for when the crisis comes. Because I have no doubt, you know, we're heading for some tough times economically, ecologically, and politically. I could wish it were not so, but all the trends tell me, yes, we are.
Yeah, periodically there are these conferences that call people together on the left or among environmentalists, and there is an attempt to do that, but it never seems to go very far.
You know, we have the World Social Forum, you know, Porto Alegre. I mean, that was a great example of that. But the problem is, and I think we have to look and be real, the problem is leadership. A lot of us on the left have some aversion to leadership, to actually having accountable organizations and focal points, you know, of authority. And that, you know, that has been a weakness. You know, we had the Occupy movements pop up and then fade away. You know,
then you have the opposite tendency, like people on the, I guess I would call them the more sectarian left, who want to proclaim themselves as the vanguard and lead everyone because they have the answers.
Yeah, and that, you know, that doesn't work either. So we need a process. We need a collaborative process to create organizations that, you know, movements of movements that have some coherency, that operate with some degree of cooperative agreement, unified voice. We need that. It's obvious we need that. We're not going to get far without it.
What is it? Hegel said, the leap to freedom is through necessity, something like that.
Yeah, and that's what we're struck with. I mean, I know as a human being, I'm, you know, especially at my age, you know, it's hard to change. Yeah. I kind of change averse, and I know that, you know, sometimes I just need a kick in the rear end to make me change, and I'm afraid those kicks are coming, and let's get ready. You know, let's start to build visions together of what we can do in our cities, our metro areas, our states, to really get ready and create strong communities that will be ready to, you know, to absorb whatever's coming and cope with it, as well as mitigate, reduce the intensity of it.
Patrick Mazza is the editor of the Raven Journal. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on February 28th, 2024.